I work and get paid like minimum wage. Sights to hit the clock by the end of the day. Hop from downtown into the hood where I stay. The only place I can't afford cause my block ain't safe. I spend most of my time working trying to bring...
Welcome to Off Kilter, the show about poverty, inequality, and everything they intersect with, powered by the Center for American Progress Action Fund. I'm Rebecca Vallis, and it's 2019. Happy New Year, friends. And boy, is 2019 starting off with a bang. Or, well, more like a shutdown. So this week on Off Kilter, everything you need to know about the shutdown and the human toll it's already taking in communities across the U.S. with seemingly no end in sight. Later in the show, what is PAYGO? And is it a good thing that it's back in force now on Capitol Hill? But first, Chad Bolt. Hey!
Rebecca!
I was just in a meeting with you earlier. You came back to the office.
Well, it's because I haven't seen enough of you in 2019 yet. I mean, it's been since 2018.
Well,
since I last saw you.
Except that you also saw me yesterday in a meeting, too, so you're totally blatantly lying on air, and that's how you're starting this segment.
Don't give away too much about the inner workings of what we do here in D.C.
Well, that's the sound of the radio studio door closing, because, Chad, we're locking you in because I have decided that you need to be the guest co-host for this episode, and maybe actually for a little bit, because as listeners of the show will know, we had to say goodbye to our beloved Slevenator at the end of 2018 because he left us for some super exciting new opportunities on the Hill, which we'll actually talk about in just a little bit. But Chad, what would you say about kind of helping us out and doing some In Case You Missed It and other things for the show in the next chunk of time?
I'm here for it. It's an honor to be asked.
Well, it's an honor to hang out with you every time I get to do it, even when it's a few times in a single day. So, Chad, people who listen to the show will already know because you're a friend of the show, but you are, I should say, and we were just talking before we started taping about your actual title, so I have learned. Your title is Associate Director of Policy.
That's right.
At Indivisible. People mm-hmm. know you're at Indivisible. I like to call you the guru of all things over there because you do so much, but thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule.
God, this is my favorite podcast because there's no other podcast that is more flattering.
That you've been on, or just period?
Just period.
Well, I do what I can, and I you know, flattery will get you everywhere, I was taught early. So Chad, I'm really excited to have you here to help us kind of kick off 2019. And I got to say, what an amazing way to ring in the new year than to be able to say the words Speaker Pelosi.
I love it.
I'm like not even used to it yet because it's just so lovely. Every time I say it, I'm like, I want to say that again.
Yep. It's really, really exciting. I mean, she's just such an extraordinary leader, and we're really excited to see her back in the reins. Back with the reins.
And in the swing with the reins, right? I mix metaphors most of when I open my mouth, and people will know that about me. So I think you should feel like you're in good company. So we, right after the midterms last fall, we had you on the show to talk about some of the amazing members of the exciting new freshman class in the House. And so I don't really want to, you know, take up a ton of your time kind of digging through all of the different members who have come in. Obviously, Representative Ocasio-Cortez is getting a ton of attention, as she deserves to, perhaps outshining almost everyone else in the freshman class. But I also wanted to give a quick plug, in case people are wondering where Jeremy went, to Representative Ilhan Omar, mm-hmm. Who is one of the first Muslim members of Congress. Jeremy, thank you for your service in advance over there, but I suspect you might be getting some income after I have outed where you headed.
Super exciting both to see her in Congress, and only slightly less exciting to see Jeremy land such a great new gig. We will miss him.
There was this amazing moment where during her swearing in, people all started emailing around, oh my God, Jeremy's on screen. And there he was, like behind her, like on the screen. And it was this amazing, I actually have a screenshot that we will definitely need to tweet. And the thing that was amazing to me was not that he was there, but that it turns out he owns a suit.
I was just about to ask if he was wearing one of his sweaters.
I was like fully expecting him to be in the like dad Christmas sweater.
Totally.
That is his usual.
I mean, that's his year-round look.
So I would just like to say I didn't know that it would be possible to roast Jeremy on this show in his absence, but Chad, we found a way.
We've done it before and we will do it again.
But so, so Jeremy aside, and Slevs, we do miss you. There's a lot to be excited about in this new Congress that that isn't just the people making up this new Democratic caucus and the freshman class. We're already starting to get kind of little, you know, bits and pieces here and there of what Congress is planning to focus on and what Democrats in Congress are planning to focus on. And we now know what H.R. 1 is going to be. So, yep. Chad, bring us up to speed. What do we know so far?
That's right. I got to tell you, Rebecca, Indivisible is really excited about this new Congress. We had a National Day of Action on January 3rd, the day the new Congress was sworn in. We had 168 events across the country to say whose house... our house.
You were so excited that you were going to get to say that just now. I know, looking at your face.
I'm wearing my biggest smile.
Was I supposed to do that with you, by the way? Is that why you were looking
at me? I mean, I was kind of leaning into it, thinking maybe you'd join me. But look, I'll give you another shot. Whose house?
Our house. Wow. Saying that with all kinds of, yes. I'm actually really excited. Sorry. I'm just laughing because you're making this like really great grin. Yes. Whose house? Our house.
I'm super excited about all of our groups. I mean, the main message here with all of these events was to say, look, we're not going anywhere. This isn't just a reactionary thing in the wake of the election of Donald Trump. We are building power that is here to stay and will last way beyond the Trump administration. So like I said, we had 168 events across the country, and really, this is the perfect time to plug in. We're here. In fact, we're bigger than ever. So if you want to go to indivisible.org and find your nearest group, you can find out when they're meeting. This is really a great time, for you to plug in with us. So, one thing that these events were largely about, and we're really excited about the new Congress, is H.R. 1. And that is the Democrats' plan to pass a comprehensive package to strengthen our democracy. we're really, really happy with what's in it and how comprehensive it is. And it stems from the premise that a healthy democracy could have rejected Trump just like a healthy body rejects a virus. But we don't have a perfectly healthy democracy. There's a lot we need to do to strengthen it and make it work for everybody. So
so what do we know about what's actually in the bill?
Exactly.
I think people are probably familiar that H.R. 1 is this anti-corruption, pro-democracy kind of package, but there's a lot in there that actually hasn't gotten a ton of attention.
Sure. Yep. And this is, it flows out of the work of Congressman John Sarbanes out of Maryland, who has led a task force in the House to put this together over the last number of years. So it really falls into three buckets. We've got bucket number one, voter empowerment and access. And that's support for things like automatic voter registration, restoring the Voting Rights Act that the Supreme Court gutted just a few years ago, federal measures to protect against state voter purges, which we alarmingly saw just in this last election and many before.
Oh, did we?
Which we did. Restoring voting rights for previously incarcerated people, early voting, and support for nonpartisan redistricting commissions to prevent gerrymandering. There's bucket two, which is about money in politics. It encourages small dollar donations and amplifies their impact with public financing. It would eliminate dark money with stronger disclosure requirements. It better empowers the Federal Election Commission. And then also riding alongside H.R. 1, it'll likely happen as a separate vote, but part of the same package, is a constitutional amendment that the House will vote on to reverse Citizens United, which has just fueled the explosion of big money in our politics. Then the third bucket is about ethics and corruption. And so this cracks down on corruption by making ethic laws more broadly applicable across the government. It demands disclosure or divestment of potential conflicts of interest for high-ranking public officials. It locks the so-called revolving door for lobbyists and government officials. And it would require, drumroll...
Yeah, well, we really got to work on these sound effects. This is so not going to cut it, but we'll do it for now.
2019 resolution. It would require release of the president and vice president's tax returns. Obviously, I've been on the show before. I've mentioned it once or twice. There's a lot we could learn, and this bill would require it.
And we're going to come back to the tax returns in a minute, but I want to acknowledge. So my little sister, her name is Kat. She has this like concept that I think is so perfect, and I use this all the time, which is that we're all basically people who have like dolls. We have strings in our backs, and when you pull the string, we have certain things that we say that are like our usuals. So for me, that would be like, does anyone have any hummus? Or does this come with tofu? Like I have like my things that she'll go, oh yeah, your string got caught, right? It's like, these are like Becca things to say.
It's like, somebody poisoned the water hole.
Yes, exactly. And Chad, for you, it would be, do it for me.
Get those tax returns ready, honey.
That's exactly right. So we know we'll come back and do more of that in a bit when we talk a little bit about some of Dems' plans for using their gavels in this new Congress, but really helpful to know that that's in there as well.
And in all seriousness, there is a lot that we could learn from seeing the president's tax returns. He's broken decades of precedent by not releasing them. It actually is a serious measure of responsible oversight, in addition to what's become my doll string tagline.
So more on that shortly. And yes, your doll string tagline, I think, is intact because it's like you didn't miss a beat there, Chad, even over the holidays. But this is, so you just walked through a bunch of different stuff. There is so much in there. And we're going to come back and do a lot more on this in this show in the weeks ahead to really dig into some of those particular pieces. But basically what you're describing is like a total fundamental overhaul of, in some ways, how Washington works and how campaigns work and how people get elected to office, mm-hmm. and how people vote and have access to the ballot box. There is so much in there.
Yep.
Would love to hear you kind of bring to life some of those individual pieces in a way that maybe helps make them a little more concrete.
Sure. I think one thing that's important to remember about HR1 is that it's in the best interest of our democracy to make these changes and for Democrats to put out a strong signal that this is a priority for them. But think of it also as a precursor for a lot of the other priorities that we want to accomplish as progressives. We are not going to lower the cost of prescription drugs unless we can get the pervasive influence of Big Pharma's money out of our politics. We are not going to reduce gun violence unless we take away the NRA's political power. And we do that by implementing the money in politics provisions and, frankly, the voter empowerment and access provisions, because, we know why Republicans implement changes to voting laws. They want to make it harder for people to vote.
Well, and those are certain people.
Certain people. And those are people who, you know, most likely are going to vote against Republicans' interests. So by this taking this comprehensive package that I think really takes a 360-degree view of things, it is, again, good for our democracy to begin with, but also sets the stage and makes it easier and more likely that we can take care of some of our other priorities too.
So just a recognition that as a threshold matter, before we even, as you said, get to the business of trying to take up and debate and pass other legislation on a whole range of different policy issues, we need to get our house in order.
That's right.
We need to make sure we have a healthy democracy. We need to make sure that we have accountable political and elected officials and that we have meaningful voting rights and on and on. So a yep. threshold matter before we can really get to anything else, and hence why it is HR1. So just a quick note on some of the politics around here. People might be listening and going like, great, what's the point if they're, you know, Dems are just going to introduce this and then, you know, we know Republicans aren't going to go with this. And so what's the point? Obviously, there's a strong message to send there. And I think you captured it really well. But there is also the possibility that individual pieces of this package might actually be ones that could move, and particularly particularly as we're watching some level of functional bipartisanship happen in the Senate on certain issues. So it's sounding like that's sort of where this goes is, Dems are going to want to pass this out of the gate as the first bill that they introduce, but then it becomes fodder for smaller bills that might individually get bipartisan support from Republicans in the Senate.
Yep. I think that's right. And I do want to underscore that I think there's just a lot of value in the narrative contrast, not just with H.R. 1, but the other bills that you'll see Democrats pass in the House, just presenting a contrast to voters as we look ahead to 2020 between, for example, an economic agenda that doesn't try to concentrate wealth in the hands of the powerful, but instead encourages and creates opportunity and shared prosperity. It doesn't take us down a reckless path of foreign policy and war making, but instead it once again prioritizes diplomacy and peace. Like, those are the kinds of narrative contrasts that I think the American people will get to see because Democrats are back in charge of the House now. That's the kind of legislation I expect to see them pass.
So another big piece of what we're going to see from Democrats in the House now that they're back in control of that chamber is, and I referenced before, gavels, is they now are in the position in charge of House committees, not just to set the agenda, not just to hold hearings, but actually to wield investigatory authority over other branches of government, including, ding, 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 the White House and the president himself. And that's a huge deal, given that we haven't seen any appetite from Republicans in Congress to do anything that puts a check on Trump. So what are we starting to hear about the investigatory agenda that Dems are planning to pursue in the House?
Yeah. This is a really exciting part of why it's so great to see Democrats back in charge of the House, because Republicans use their control of the House to conduct virtually zero oversight of the Trump administration. In fact, they did the opposite. They basically empowered him to do whatever he wanted. And so we're going to see a real change here, I think. If you would like to learn more about Congress's oversight authority, I would encourage you to go to indivisible.org because we've got Indivisible Guide 2.0, Indivisible on Offense. And there's an entire chapter there that you can read about how you can make sure your Democratic House member is using the full extent of their oversight authorities.
And we'll make sure to have a link to that on our Nerdy Syllabus.
In the Nerdy
page.
Syllabus.
Because it's what we do.
Great. So I think we should and will see investigations conducted by the committees of jurisdiction and the oversight subcommittees on things like what's going on at the border. Why are children dying in the custody of border agencies? How many children remain separated from their families, and what efforts are being made to reunite them? And who's responsible for all of this? How did it get so to such a degree of atrocity? investigations into Betsy DeVos and other cabinet secretaries who have personal entanglements and conflicts of interest with the industries that their departments and agencies purportedly oversee. I think we'll see, I hope we see investigations into ACA sabotage. Why did the Trump administration cut off funding for navigators? Why did they turn off healthcare.gov at periods when people would likely be going there to find health insurance? Why did they hold cost-sharing reduction payments hostage that are intended to help low-income families afford their copays and deductibles? I mean, the list goes on and on. And then, of course, look, this would not be a Chad Bolt guest appearance on Off Kilter if I did not say the House Ways and Means Committee is uniquely empowered to seek and obtain the president's tax returns.
So as my sister would say, your string got caught there, Chad.
That's right. Get those tax returns ready, honey.
But in all seriousness, this seems not to be something that we're actually hearing from Democrats on that committee appetite in going after. What's going on there?
Yeah, it's really too bad. So the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee is a Democrat from Massachusetts named Richie Neal. And he has signaled that he prefers Donald Trump to volunteer his tax returns as opposed to using his existing authority as chairman of the Ways and Means Committee to get them. Respectfully, I would say to the congressman that the president has had a number of years to volunteer his tax returns, and he has not done so against decades of precedent. And that suggests to me that maybe more extraordinary measures are needed. This is not totally unprecedented authority. The House majority has used it as recently as 2014. And again, there's just so much that I think the American people deserve to know that we could learn through his tax returns and the tax returns of his over 500 business entities. And that's one, how much did he personally benefit from the tax law that he and his Republican enablers in Congress pushed through? There was a big, it should have been a bombshell in the New York Times, October 4th, that revealed just the extraordinary lengths that Trump and his businesses went to avoid paying the taxes they owe. So we could learn, is that a sustained systemic practice by Trump and his business entities to go to extraordinary lengths to avoid paying taxes? And has he paid the taxes he legally owes? But we could also find out, what are his foreign entanglements and those of his business entities across the world? And do they present a conflict of interest? I think they likely do. When he's conducting foreign policy on behalf of the United States. These are all things that the American people deserve to know. And now Democrats, Chairman Neal in particular, have the authority to find out. And I hope they do.
Well, I hope so, too. And I hope that they're just thinking really hard about how they want to do it and haven't told us that they do yet.
That's right. Look, this is the charitable version of this. Yep. If I come back on future episodes, we'll see how charitable I remain.
You hear that? Folks on the Hill, this is Chad telling you there's the easy way and there's the hard way. And you don't want to find out what the hard way is because Chad plays kickball. And does trivia. Definitely a scary guy. We're running out of time because the next thing that we need to talk about is, of course, the government being in shutdown. But in the last minute or so that we have just to sort of set things up for this episode and introduce people to the 2019 Congress, the 119th Congress, Chad, what are you most excited about that we haven't talked about yet that are priorities that you're hoping that the new Democratic House takes up?
I've been thinking a lot about this, and I know we're going to talk about PAYGO later to give everyone a sweet little preview. But I've been thinking a lot about the economy and Democrats and their policymaking around it. And so I really hope that we can just really drill home a contrast in who the Democratic Party works for and who the Republican Party works for. We got to see 2 years of who the Republican Party works for in the Trump administration alone. They gave a huge tax cut to the wealthy and corporations that did virtually nothing for everyone else. They deregulated some of the biggest banks in the country, putting us at greater risk of another financial crisis. And they did it because they are interested in serving their wealthy donors and their wealthy friends and making them better off. You are going to see a contrast between that and what Democrats do in the House. I would expect them to do things like pass legislation that raises the minimum wage, for example. Things that I think, paid family leave is another issue that's likely to move early in this Congress. Things that actually make the lives of everyday Americans and especially working families better. I think it'll be a useful contrast for Americans and voters to see as we move towards 2020.
And little birdie has told me that we should be seeing things in the coming weeks that sound like minimum wage increase bills and maybe even things to do with jobs for particularly vulnerable folks who are at the edges of the labor market and other good stuff to come. So a lot more to dig into that I know I'll be having you back to talk about, Chad,
because definitely.
You have been voluntold for this role.
I love it. And by the way, Rebecca, this is not something that is out of our control. If you want your Democratic member or your Republican member for that matter, but particularly your Democratic member of the House, if you've got one, if you want them going big, if you want them going bold, we've got a guide, and I mentioned it earlier, but I'll re-up it again. We've got a guide that tells you how to do that. So go to indivisible.org and download Indivisible on Offense.
Chad Bolt is the Director of Strategic Plugs at Indivisible. Shameless and strategic plugs that I love and that I appreciate. And you can find all of that on our Nerdy Syllabus page, of course. So don't go away. More Off Kilter after the break. We'll be talking shutdown.
You've got us 24 hours a day on your mobile smartphone via the Progressive Voices app. This is the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn.
You're listening to Off Kilter. I'm Rebecca Vallis and still joined by Chad Bolt. I feel like I should come up with a different title for you every time we do a new segment.
I'm going to leave that to you.
Director of Shameless Plugs, actually, is what I came up with last time at Indivisible. It's still with me for this episode.
We already used that one.
I know. I don't get to just keep it. No, I have to come up with a new one every segment. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Next segment, I will have a new title for you by the next segment. But we are joined by Sam Berger, a senior advisor at CAP, and also part of the team managing the 2013 shutdown in the Obama administration. And so with shutdown as the word of the hour, the day, the week, now almost the month, we're actually approaching that point. We're heading into week three of this shutdown. We thought we would bring Sam back on the show to help us break down what the heck is going on with this this goat rodeo that we are all currently living. So Sam, thanks so much for coming back on the show.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
So Sam, before we get into what the shutdown means, how it's impacting people across this country and communities across this country, and where things go from here, I want to sort of look in the rearview mirror a little bit because it's helpful, I think, to as sort of a grounding to remember how this all got started, mm-hmm. where this all came from. So how did we get here? Why are we in shutdown, Sam?
So Democrats and Republicans had come together on a bipartisan agreement to keep funding the government. They'd struck the agreement. The Trump administration was on board. And then, unfortunately, somebody let Trump watch TV that night. And people said some mean things about him on Fox News, and he thought the best way to handle this situation was to blow up the whole deal, shut down the government, and harm millions of people.
And this is all back in December.
You know, and it was interesting. A lot of times elected officials will sort of try and, you know, pretend, oh, well, it's not me, it's you. But in this case, Trump got all the TV cameras together to say, just to be clear, I'm the one who's doing this. It's me, Donald Trump, shutting down the government. I'm totally responsible, and I'm never going to blame anybody else.
I kind of want to come in with the exact quote because it's even more damning than what you just said with your paraphrase. He said, to quote him at his meeting with Pelosi and Schumer in December, he said, quote, I will take the mantle. I will be the one to shut it down. I'm not going to blame you for it. I have to say, as a recovering lawyer, like, it doesn't get more thorough or complete than that as a statement about this being his shutdown.
Yeah, although I do think we need to do, like, narrator's voice. He did blame other people for the shutdown. Right? But yeah, no, I mean, that was very clear. And so, you know, this is the Trump shutdown, the Trump temper tantrum. That's what's going on. That's why we're here.
So now take us to present day. We're at the point where we are, as we're taping, we're on day, I think, 20 of the shutdown, 19 or 20.
Yeah, I think we may be actually at 19, but you start to lose a little bit of track.
I mean, it is Blur's day for me, yeah. Most days. But we're headed into week three, mm-hmm. of this shutdown. We're on track for this shutdown to be the longest in history. Mm-hmm. What's going on?
Well, I mean, basically the... Trump is continuing to refuse to take a deal. I mean, there are multiple deals on the table, each of which is a compromise. It's very interesting. You know, you hear this Republican line, Democrats need to compromise. They did compromise That was the compromise deal that everybody agreed to and voted on and was going to go to the president until he threw his temper tantrum. So what the issue isn't that Democrats aren't going to compromise. The issue is, A, no one knows what Trump wants. B, what he keeps asking for, nobody wants. The American people don't want it. It's a wall that nobody wants. It's a wall that Mexico was supposed to pay for. It's a wall that's ineffective and is really a monument to racism and xenophobia. I mean, that's what it is. And so there's no way in which Democrats are ever going to go along with this. You know, they've been clear if the issue is border security, they're happy to have a conversation about things that would actually improve border security. But that's not what this conversation is about. And in fact, there's already money in the bill to do that. So, you know, I think what we're really dealing with is basically Trump throwing a temper tantrum and a bunch of elected Republicans trying to decide whether or not they want to stand up to him on behalf of the country or not.
So what exactly happens when the government shuts down? It feels like it's good to sort of do a refresher since people mm-hmm. probably remember from past shutdowns that, federal workers are furloughed in many cases. At this point, hundreds of thousands of them, and that's gotten a lot of attention. People set to miss their first paycheck. But what exactly happens when the government shuts down, and what are the consequences?
So this is what we call a partial shutdown, meaning that some parts of the government are funded and other parts aren't. But basically, when a shutdown occurs, a whole bunch of activities cease. Pretty much anything that isn't necessary to protect life and property, that isn't otherwise funded or part of the president's constitutional responsibilities, stops. And for workers, they're either furloughed, meaning they're sent home, or they have to show up work, but they aren't paid. So you have 800,000 workers who aren't getting paid right now, either because they're furloughed at home or because they're being asked to be on the job. And this includes everyone from the Secret Service that's protecting the president and the first family right now, to law enforcement, to folks at NOAA, folks all across TSA, people that are making sure that airport traffic controllers, everybody, tons and tons of people, 800,000 people. And so those folks are all being asked to work or being asked to sit at home without getting any money.
So, and Chad, you're being bizarrely quiet over here, just like watching like tennis over here.
I'm just stewing. I'm just stewing.
Chad's just really angry.
Because Rebecca, you know what? You know what Mitch McConnell's doing about this? Instead of putting the House-passed legislation on the Senate floor for a vote, which would very likely pass, he instead wants to pretend that it is business as usual in the Senate. Foreign policy? Let's do it. Federal lands management? You got it. I got bills coming up. No, that is absolutely not what the Senate should be doing. First and foremost, we should be voting to reopen the government. Let's get these federal workers back to work. Let's get the government programs functioning again so that folks across the country aren't hurt by the shutdown any more than they already have been. And so what you saw this week was Democrats deny the votes necessary on a procedural vote to move on to legislation related to Middle East policy. Like, we will probably get to that later, but first and foremost, let's get the government reopened. And so Democrats are fairly unified in that position, and we think it's the exact right place for them to be. This is the right strategy. It's not business as usual in the Senate. Let's get the government reopened, and then Mitch McConnell can move on to other things. But what he shouldn't do is pretend that this isn't happening, because it only enables Trump's intransigence on this. And you're starting to see, I think, a few cracks. There are Republican senators coming out, particularly Republican senators on the Appropriations Committee that took a lot of time to write these bills to fund the government. And they're starting to say, like, look, we actually probably should vote on legislation that the House passed to get the government open. And that's what they should be saying.
This actually raises an important question. I should have stressed this. Despite what some people might think, Mitch McConnell himself is not shut down or furloughed. So his complete absence from any of the discussions and the negotiations, not required by law, just required by Mitch. So that is a confusion that some people have had, and I think it's important to stress. I mean, it is sort of incredible. Mitch McConnell says, I don't know what I can do. I just run the Senate. You got to talk to some of these other guys. I mean, and the fact that people aren't focusing on this more, I think is concerning. You know, look, Mitch McConnell I mean, we all know he doesn't really stand for anything other than political power. So in that sense, it can be easy to move him. If you convince him it's going to be bad for the Republican Senate for the shutdown to continue, then he'll stop it. Until then, he's just going to let it go because he doesn't really care. Doesn't care about the people that are being harmed. Doesn't care about the programs that are shut down. His question is just how long will Republicans maintain control of the Senate? And that's why it's so important for people to be putting pressure on, to be reaching out to their senators and trying to ask, what's going on? Where are you in this? Why is it that everyone has decided that, you know, Donald Trump throwing this temper tantrum gets to decide whether 800,000 workers get paid or not, gets to decide whether millions of small businesses are able to access loans, whether farmers can access loans, whether homeowners, new homeowners can access loans? Why does Donald Trump's temper tantrum, why does Fox News and Ann Coulter get to make that decision? Where's the Senate on this? Where's Mitch McConnell on this? It's a question that people really need to be asking.
And if folks have Republican senators, when they do make those calls, and we do need you making those calls, they can remind their Republican senator that the Senate unanimously passed legislation to open the government and sent it to the House at the end of the last Congress. Now, because of the way Congress works, when a new one starts, you have to go back and pass legislation out of the House and Senate again. But the House has given the Senate options. The House has passed a package of bills and one standalone bill that would fund the Department of Homeland Security until February. They are now, just at the end of this past week, they passed individual standalone bills in case the Senate would prefer to tackle it that way. So the ball is in Mitch McConnell's court. Trump is the cause of the shutdown, but Mitch McConnell is complicit and prolonging it.
It's sort of like the thoughts and prayers strategy, right? Here, it's oh, I don't know what I could do except for saying I'm really sorry this is happening, and no, he's totally in a seat of among the greatest power of all humans who could do something about this, and needs to be hearing from people. So, Sam, you started to walk through some of the other consequences of this partial shutdown. Yeah. The 800,000 federal workers, that's a huge piece of this, and the impacts are felt in communities across this country, but there's a ton else that's really just been brought to a standstill or been halted in some way because of this shutdown. What are some of the impacts that are going to affect lower income folks or working class folks a little more?
Well, one of the first things we need to talk about is contractors. You know, the federal government, it's enormous. It does a lot of contract work, people performing, you know, janitorial services, food services, things of that nature. And those folks aren't getting paid now. And they're not going to ever get paid. They don't get back pay when the shutdown ends. And so that's challenging. It's challenging for the people doing the work. It's challenging for the small business owners that run these companies trying to figure out how they're going to make payroll. It's challenging for everybody. Obviously, as I mentioned before, you know, there's a huge number of loan programs, you know, federally backed loans that go to farmers, new homeowners, small businesses. You know, none of those can be accessed. There are knock-on effects from, for example, you know, so the parks are still open, but obviously the parks are in significantly degraded capacity. And in some cases, parks have had to be closed because of damage being done to the parks themselves. That hurts small businesses, people around the area, people that work in the parks, not federal employees, but others. You know, there's knock-on effects throughout the entire economy. And the federal government does a lot of things for a lot of people. And so when you shut it down, there's a lot of things that stop. And, you know, the federal government, this is another thing that I think is important for people to understand. Federal government programs aren't designed to shut down, to just stop on a dime. And so there isn't really a safety net for a lot of folks. And so unless it can continue because either it has funding or because it's necessary for life and property, you know, there are folks... they're just sort of left down the cold. You know, another one is public housing agencies are seeing funding shortages, which can cause issues for many of the services that they provide. You know, the list goes on and on and on.
Well, and you know, hearing you talk about how there is no real safety net at this point, I mean, it's actually the safety net itself that is being halted to a standstill in some cases. If this shutdown continues on much longer, you mentioned housing, and that's a piece of that. But it's also some of our key nutrition programs that are potentially at risk. You mentioned housing, so I want to stay with that for a second. and one of the key programs here that's at risk if funding runs out, which it's on track to if the shutdown lasts all that much longer and heads into, say, February and deep into February, is public housing. It's rental assistance, and that could impact 2.2 million low-income households potentially if that program runs out of funding. So to tell us a little bit about what we know about some of the programs that might not be currently at risk because they have funding for the moment, but are actually set to run dry if this shutdown drags on.
Yeah, I mean, so there are programs that we're going to see. So USDA recently announced that they're taking some steps in the nutrition programs to try and extend basically the deadline in which things get, you know, very problematic. So people will be able to get SNAP a little bit longer than anticipated, which is good. They're trying to do some stuff with WIC. This is a program that helps new mothers. School lunches, I think, will be okay for a while. But it's Trump says it's going to go months and months. I mean, it can't go months and months because pretty soon these programs are going to still run out of money. I mean, this step has taken it longer. I think, you know, in many of these cases, we're looking more towards March, where at first we were worried about February. But if it goes months and months, these programs are going to break down and there's going to be nothing there. And there are folks who depend on it, millions of people who depend on these programs.
And Sam, tell me if I have this right, but what we're seeing out of a number of different agencies is they're trying to come up with these workarounds to make sure that the basic services they provide can be preserved to some degree, at least. You know, for example, a couple of weeks ago, we were thinking like, man, the shutdown can really impact tax season. Like, people aren't going to get their tax refunds. And then the Trump administration comes out and says like, oh no, don't worry. Like, we're still going to send out tax returns. Well, I mean, think about the IRS. There are tons of people who rely on the IRS for help filing their taxes, and there's going to be much longer wait times to get that assistance. There are volunteers that work in tax preparation services on a volunteer basis that call the IRS for help. Much longer wait times for them. I mean, low-income families rely on that tax return that they get in February, March. And so while they still may get it, there could be significant delays, even though the Trump administration has come up with some kind of workaround. What we could do is just avoid all of these workarounds and just fund the government, put people back to work on behalf of the American people.
Yeah, I mean, I want to separate out, though, SNAP from what IRS is doing, because I think what IRS is doing is actually illegal.
Interesting.
They
tell us more, Sam.
Well, look,
Chad's like, illegal.
Well, I mean, they're not allowed to make these payments. IRS told you they weren't allowed to make these payments. Yeah. They said that back in the Obama administration. They said in the Trump administration. They said in 2018. They said in 2019. They said they couldn't make them when it wasn't filing season and when it was filing season. Why is that? Well, you know, normally you can only make payments that are necessary for life, to protect life. Or property, meaning the government's property. And then in some cases, you can still have these programs where there's funding that's there if you're required to make payments. So basically, the issue is you have funding to make the payment, but you don't have funding to actually have the people make the payment. Someone's got to like figure out who gets the payment when they get it, mm-hmm. and you lick the stamp and put it on the envelope, even though I know they don't do that, run the computer systems. So, but it's only if you actually have to make the payment at a time certain. So the example being Social Security. There's funding for Social Security, and payments have to go out on the date certain. It's clear what day that is, the amount that it is. It's got to go out. It's not like that with tax refunds. There Yep. isn't a time that tax refunds have to be sent out by at all. Mm-hmm. Now, at a certain point after the end of tax filing season, you start getting interest payments that accrue. And one could make an argument that at that point, and here we're talking about late May, that perhaps there's like a government property issue, although I think that's still challenging. Mm-hmm. But no, there's no reason that these payments have to go out the door in February other than that there's political pressure that the Trump administration is facing because they walked into a shutdown and said, oh, we'll just shut down the government. And then they looked around and said, huh, seems like the government does a lot of things. Why didn't anyone tell us? And I can tell you there are a bunch of career officials saying, we were screaming at you about this mm-hmm. and you didn't listen because you never listen. And now here's where we are. They're desperately scrambling around trying to undo their own mistakes. And sometimes they're taking legal actions, as with SNAP, and sometimes they're taking illegal actions, as with IRS. And sometimes they're taking actions that are going to screw up the very thing that they're doing, which is like parks, right? Where they say, okay, everyone can come into the parks. Oops, we don't have enough people to clear the human waste. Oops, we don't have an ability to keep people from driving off wherever they want, cutting down trees or doing anything, you know. these are serious problems. This is why in 2013 we shut down the parks, because they told us we can't have the people to ensure the safety of the parks, the safety of the folks who come through. And we said, okay, we'll take the political hit, because this is the right thing to do to protect the parks. Unfortunately, the Trump administration has decided differently.
Yeah, and I have to say, there was this day where I feel like the media realized that that our national parks were literally covered in human and like there was a flurry of stories all around that. Like, that was real. That is actually a thing that happened, because, as you said, this administration is scrambling so much to like even just get it a handle on what the impacts of their own actions and the president's actions are here. I want to add a little bit of clarity to some of what's going on with the nutrition side and the housing side, because I just want to be clear to all of our listeners. No cuts are technically in effect for people who are helped by the supplemental nutrition assistance program, food stamps, or school lunch, or WIC benefits, or housing assistance. These all are programs that are still currently in force, and benefits are still being paid. USDA actually took some action this week. As you said, they sort of scrambling to try to put a Band-Aid on things. So what they did was to assure people that February benefits are going to be paid. But if this shutdown continues to last, quote, months, if not years, which is those are the president's own words, what we could see as soon as March is families seeing a cut of actually close to half of their food stamp benefits, right? These are the kinds of impacts that we're going to see. And we're actually already starting to see some real scares in the housing context, because a whole bunch of contracts, over 1,000 affordable housing contracts, all expired in December. And oops, that was because a whole bunch of HUD staff weren't in place. They'd been furloughed under this shutdown. And so now you got 100,000 low-income tenants at risk of being evicted. Yep. And you got the administration being like, oops, maybe we should tell them not to evict people. Like, these are the kinds of things that are happening. So it is total and utter chaos. Mm-hmm. Sam, in the last minute that we have with you, because there's a lot more we could talk about here, people are probably all listening and wondering, but where does it go from here? When does this end? And I feel like what I want to do is to put you on the spot in the way that Bill Murray did in Ghostbusters, where he actually had a guest on his fictional TV show. And this was the sequel. This was Ghostbusters 2, to be clear, for anyone who's like, oh my God, that wasn't Ghostbusters 1. You're right. It was Ghostbusters 2. And in it, he asks people to predict when the end of the world, right, is going to happen. And they pick a date. They pick dates. And one of the people actually picked Valentine's Day from a couple of years back. The world didn't end. But Sam, if I were to do what Bill Murray did and say, when is the shutdown going to end, what would you say?
Well, the first thing I would say is a lot of this is dependent on Trump. And remember, you know, there are a lot of people at the White House whose job it is to figure out what Trump is going to do on a given day. And they can't do it. So a little bit unfair to ask me. But putting that aside, you know, I think that this is probably something that's going to end, if not next week, then the week after. And the reason for that is shutdowns, the harm and damage from shutdowns, it's not linear. It's exponential. It gets worse and worse and worse. So day 10 is not 5 days worse than day 5. Right? Day 15 isn't 5 days worse than day 10. Things get worse and worse and worse. And I think you're starting to see some Republicans in the Senate realize that. I think ultimately what's going to happen is you're going to get enough Republican senators who come to their senses, realize that causing damage to millions and millions and millions of people because Trump doesn't like his TV coverage is inexcusable. And they're going to quietly tell Mitch McConnell this needs to end. And then suddenly Mitch McConnell is going to pop up from his hole. Little Groundhog Day reference for you're doing. Yes.
Oh, that's happening. But I haven't seen it.
That is happening.
Yeah, Chad has seen none of these movies, by the way. But you already knew that, listeners.
Spoiler alert, Chad, Bill Murray's in that movie.
I did know that.
He's not the groundhog. Just to be clear, he doesn't play the groundhog.
Second spoiler alert there. But anyway, you know, then Mitch McConnell will quietly tell the Trump this needs to end, and then he'll either declare this illegally, declare an emergency and try and illegally build a wall. And then we'll all be having a conversation about that, or he'll make up some nonsense about how actually his trade deal is building a wall of better trade deals or whatever nonsense. You know, you can never tell what this guy's going to say. But that's how I think it ends. It ends with Republicans in the Senate realizing that they need to take a stand. And that means that it ends with people around the country putting pressure on them. And then seeing that pressure reflected in actions by their elected representatives.
Did someone say put pressure on your members of Congress? Go to indivisible.org. We've got call scripts for Republican and Democratic senators. It's important to say Republicans reopen the government. This is getting real dumb. And to your Democrats, say thank you for standing strong. What we don't want is a compromise on the wall. What we do want you to do is continue denying Trump his wall money, because the House has already passed legislation to get the government reopened. And what you should also keep doing is preventing the Senate from proceeding to other business until we finally get this taken care of. So okay. Say thank you for your Democrats, because most of them are on board with that strategy.
And Chad, your string got caught there again, and boy, was I glad that it did. So lots of good things for folks to be doing right now to raise their voices with members of Congress to tell them this is absolutely unacceptable. And just to close out with words, in case anyone possibly just listened to this conversation and is wondering, but whose shutdown was it? It is Trump's shutdown. Quote, I will take the mantle. I will be the one to shut it down. I'm not going to blame you for it. And we know what the narrator will say. Sam Berger is senior advisor at the Center for American Progress. He was part of the shutdown team in 2013 under Obama, handling this kind of stuff very differently, I recall.
Legally. We were handling it legally. That was a primary difference that I would...
Kudos to you, Sam.
Yeah, it was... It's a novel approach, but I think it bore the test of time there.
And we'll have you back sometime soon. But in the meantime, we're gonna see how your predictions pan out.
Oh, thanks.
Don't go away. More Off Kilter after the break. Chad, sticking around, because we're going to be talking a little bit about PAYGO.
All right.
Hi, I'm Gianna Garrell from Progressive Voices. Today, the angry roar of the conservative media machine dominates TV and radio, threatening to drown out and push out anyone who dares to discuss our progressive perspectives and ideals. But we can't let that happen. We have too many strong, smart, and important progressive voices who need to be heard. That's why here at PV, we're building a 21st century progressive media universe. One where all the best in progressive media can come together, rise above the static and the noise, and be heard by anyone, anywhere. And we need your help. We're in the middle of a critical campaign to make our dream of 21st century progressive media universe a reality. But we can't do it without grassroots support from people like you. Head over to progressivevoices.com to see how you can help. Please support this important progressive mission, because with your help, we can make sure all our progressive voices are heard.
You're listening to Off Kilter. I'm Rebecca Vallis. And Chad, you're still with me, right?
I haven't worn out my welcome yet.
Are you still awake?
Boy, I'm about to.
So I don't have a new title for you, I'm sorry, because I think you're still the director of Shameless Plugs after how you just closed out that last segment.
Cruising on Shameless Plugs. Go to indivisible.org.
Why would you possibly change your title if that's what it's going to be? So we are shifting gears a little bit here to talk about something else that is another one of the words of the day that folks are probably seeing everywhere. It's not even quite a word. It's more of a, can we call it a portmanteau? I guess it kind of is, because it's like bringing words together, but it's also Washington, like garbage language that means nothing to normal people.
So bad.
But is so important to understand, because it is the topic of a very live, very hot debate going on in Congress right now. And that word / portmanteau / something is PAYGO.
I just might name my trivia team after it.
Are you going to call the trivia team PAYGO?
I don't know. It needs some workshopping.
Yeah.
It needs some workshopping.
Let's work on that. It needs a rest of it, like PAYGO blank.
Exactly.
Okay, we'll work on this. But to help us understand PAYGO, because to understand the debate that's currently going on, you have to get pretty wonky, you have to get pretty nerdy. We brought in one of the biggest nerds I know, and that is Pat Garofalo, who is the managing editor of TalkPoverty.org and has done tons of reporting on PAYGO and actually previous versions of it that were called different things over the years. Pat, thanks so much for coming back on the show to nerd out a little bit.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
So, Pat, what is PAYGO?
It is a silly name.
You looked at me like I was asking you an existential question there, just for the record.
It's really deep. There's a lot of levels here. PAYGO is an onion. No. PAYGO is a silly name for a budget rule essentially has been around in various versions since 1990. At the very top level, it's the idea that new programs, new government spending should always be offset by either spending cuts elsewhere or new tax increases to pay for them so that the deficit isn't always getting bigger because you're adding new programs on top of old programs.
Hence the term. It's sort of like pay as you go, right? Except you lost the as you, which is why I was not sure if I should call that a portmanteau, but hey, we're going with it. So this is back in the news because there's a sort of hot debate going on in the House right now, actually among Democrats, about whether this is a thing to put back in force. But before we talk about the politics, I'm going to make you give us the history on this. And the history goes back many years, actually, to when it was a different term and a different concept. And it's been a lot of different things over the years. So bring us up to speed on the history behind this this garbage DC term that actually is really important to understand.
So it came into being in 1990, the initial version, and stuck around through the Clinton administration. And part of the reason it was brought into being was because everyone started freaking out about the Reagan deficits. And so H.W. Bush was in office, and then the rules continued through the Clinton administration. Once there were surpluses at the end of the second Clinton term, it was basically allowed to expire because, oh, now we had all this money to spend and people didn't care so much about the deficit. But Republicans have brought it back in various ways over the years. The most recent iteration of this was in 2010. President Obama actually signed into law a PAYGO rule that said new mandatory spending needed to be offset elsewhere. Republicans then morphed that into something when they took control of the House called CutGo. Though we're not paying for things, we're only cutting things now. And they took tax increases off the table. So their tweak to the rule was that you would pay for new spending only by cutting old spending. Brings us to present day, wherein House Democrats want to get rid of CutGo and bring back PAYGO, which puts tax increases back on the table.
So, and Chad, you look sort of like you're stewing again. So I know you're going to, you have some, wait, is it now? Is it now?
No, it's okay. I mean, actually where Pat left us off, actually, it's an important change that Democrats made because just to underscore this, under the Republican version of the rule, new spending had to be offset by cutting other spending. And so if we wanted to pay for something, for example, by raising taxes on the wealthy, that did not satisfy Republicans' CutGo rule. So the change up to the point of the story where Pat has brought us so far is okay. All right, so I'm just going to...
So checking in with Chad. He's doing
we're
okay
cool.
over
we're
here.
Cool. Chad's cool.
Chad's cool so far.
Everyone's cool.
But not for much longer. Pat, why is Chad getting pissed off?
So the debate over this rule kind of comes down to a couple of different buckets. And the people who are upset about this rule are folks on the more progressive end of the Democratic caucus. And their main objections lie on two grounds, one sort of practical and one more theoretical. The practical objection is that this is a rule that could prevent, say, Medicare for All program or a Green New Deal from being passed into law because you couldn't deficit finance those programs. The reaction to that from people who are usually in favor of PAYGO is that, well, if the thing is important enough, then they would just waive the rule for that bill. And to that argument's credit, PAYGO has been waived time and time and time again over the years. It hasn't actually restrained anything. These rules were in effect when Republicans passed tax cuts. They didn't care. They just waived them.
And almost $2 trillion in tax cuts that have blown up the deficit that they're now complaining about. Interesting, right?
Interesting.
So clearly easily waivable.
Exactly, yeah. This law has been on the books since 2010, and it clearly did not stop the Republicans from passing that tax cut. So on the practical level, it doesn't necessarily mean a whole lot. But then critics say that on a more theoretical level, this says that Democrats are paying more attention to the deficit than is warranted by economic conditions, that they shouldn't be worrying so much about the deficit given the economic conditions of the current day, and that by talking up this rule, they are focusing on the wrong thing and paying attention to a problem that doesn't really exist.
So do you think that that carries water as an argument against it? I mean, we're watching this sort of intra-party debate play out between basically Democratic leaders like Nancy Pelosi and others and the congressional progressives. progressive caucus, and we've got leadership saying, let's restore PAYGO, which, as Chad noted, is different from CUTGO, and that it's really important to understand those differences. We got the CPC being like, yo, why are we obsessing in the ways that you're describing? What do you know from sort of the economic nerd perspective about which side has facts on their side, or is it somewhere in between?
I think it's not so much facts as your worldview and how you talk about things, but there is certainly something to the argument that by talking about PAYGO, you make it sound like deficit spending is always bad, and that's definitely not true. There are plenty of moments when deficit spending is really important and really key and is needed to fill gaps in the economy that the private sector can't fill. And so the argument is that by talking about PAYGO in the way that it's talked about and saying that every new thing needs to be offset by an old thing, you're at least rhetorically saying that we can't do big things.
Now, what are the, in terms of the arguments for it, we're hearing from leadership that this is something that they want to put back in place, but dig a little bit in more on like, is there a case for it? And should we actually be saying, yeah, actually they have a strong argument here?
The case for it is that debt is not a non-problem. You know, eventually some.
That's all the time we had for this interview this week, but you can find the full conversation on the podcast version of Off Kilter anywhere podcasts are found. And that does it for this week's episode of Off Kilter, powered by the Center for American Progress Action Fund. I'm your host, Rebecca Vallis. The show is produced by Will Urquhart and David Ballard. Find us on Facebook and Twitter at Off Kilter Show, and you can find us on the airwaves on the Progressive Voices Network and the We Act Radio Network, or anytime as a podcast on iTunes. See you next week.
I want freedom. Freedom. But it's calling me back. I feel my spirit is revealing the mouth. We just trying to get freedom.